And he pushed me in a direction where there was some men waiting for me. And the men expected lap dances, stripping, and other various sex acts. And if I did not please them or bring in enough money, I would be beaten. So every night that we went there, I had sexual contact with many different men, stripping, dancing, performing various sex acts that they asked for. Nothing would be off limits. If I didn't bring enough men, enough money, I would be beaten. But if I did, my father would be pleased. Rachel Lloyd, who works for GEMS, founder of GEMS, talks about the fact that sexual exploitation of girls does not happen in a vacuum. It happens in a world where girls are not valued. And I would add that there is a demand for her sexually, even as a young girl. This was the case in my life. I went to a school, lived in a neighborhood, had family members, but sometimes even attended church. The family made sure I was baptized as an infant, that I made a first communion, but no one saw. And what I mean is everyone looked away. There were women in the family who knew that sexual abuse was occurring and that would see me being taken out of the house at night, but they just looked away. People said I was shy and learning disabled. But what you really know is that speaking gets you killed. This is how life is for an exploited girl, living with a father who abuses, pimps you out for money, not because of poverty or drugs, but simply because sexual exploitation and desire. I did not know I had any value at all. I was no one's daughter. I simply was another girl who was sold for sex. As I grew older, the exploitation continued. I tried to run once. I know people ask that question, but I was almost killed. Even as a teen, I was forced into prostitution. I was drugged and forced into sexual encounters with men. I always dreamt of having someone to rescue me. As I got older, I had some ability to fight, some ability to work against exploitation. Maybe I thought, this is a life. If this is a life I have, then I don't want it. Through the pain, terror, and trauma of exploitation, it forces you into hiding. It is a survival mode. I hid in a sense from everyone else. The only people who I knew were people who were involved in the exploitation and used me. Pain, whether it is the pain of sexual exploitation or the pain of abuse or the pain of a loss, we hide ourselves. And I believe that it is a gift we are given so that we don't give up and die. But to live, to survive, is what is needed at the moment. And there comes a moment when we must come out and fight for our lives. As a community, as a country, we must care deeply and speak out on the behalf of girls like me. And this will change everything. Because even though I was not treated as a daughter and no one saw me, there are millions of girls out there this very night who need you to see her. And once rescued, they need you to care for her and walk beside her, because she literally will have no one and only knows how to survive. I never knew anyone who had been kind or loving in any way. And so that is how I saw the world. However, I did not stay in hiding. The pain of being exploited would take a long time to heal. It is no easy road to recovery. It is a miracle that I stand before you today. Today, my voice is no longer silenced. There is no duct tape over my mouth anymore. I will speak out on behalf of girls across the United States and the world who need someone to speak on her behalf. No one saw me, but I see the millions of girls today who are just like me, being exploited by their fathers, uncles, grandfathers, boyfriends, neighbors, and others who manipulate and steal their girlhood. I was helped, and it was nothing short of a miracle that it worked. People in my high school assisted me with scholarships and assistance to college about an hour from my home. And once admitted, my father bribed me with a car, although I was not allowed to drive, and to bribe me to stay home. But I ran as fast as I could through that door. At this time, I also became part of a local church and became a follower of Christ. This is a huge part of my journey, and God is really the reason I'm able to stand before you today. All the research indicates that I should be dead, addicted to drugs, or involved in the sex industry with my past. It is a reality that women and girls who experience similar life circumstances may experience post-traumatic stress syndrome and other trauma-related symptoms at least at the same rate as veterans, with 69%. Some years ago, my father saw me and demanded that I come crawling back to him, begging him, and come back to him. And as a result, I did not, of course, and as a result, I have been cut off from the family, which I never had. And I have always been an orphan of sorts. I was able to graduate from college and teach elementary school. I have worked in the local church in a pastoral role, and I have a heart for those most of society does not even see. Most recently, I'm completing, in 4 weeks, a master's degree from Fuller Theological Seminary in missiology, focusing on children at risk, especially those who have been domestically trafficked. When one like me goes from silent to having a voice, we are no longer hidden, but we are free. And that we are all meant to be, we are truly alive. One of the most healing things is to know that there are people who know my story and who care about me now. I was never meant to be that girl. In life, I can state that God came and rescued me. It is by the miraculous power and grace of God that I stand before you today to attest what a good, miraculous, amazing God we have. I believe that the perpetrators will be dealt with, even if it may be in their last days. It would be great if they all stood before the law court, but the laws are in process, and that may not be done right now. You see, we tell our stories to attest of the goodness of God. I am much more than the story. My story is important, and I hope that you see the hope and promise that is possible in the lives of millions of girls that are exploited. Each one is a person, valuable and purposed. My story is a part of who I am. I cannot deny it. It is pain into purpose, a life redeemed. I am loved, valued, and purposed, and have a rich future, and so are you, no matter what has happened in your life. When I heard the great truth of God, I literally ran to him. He rescued me from my father, and I can never turn back. Everyone is needed in this fight for the lives of girls and women who are being sexually exploited. You see, because of the goodness of others and the kindness, I'm able to stand here today and proclaim freedom and break the silence on this modern-day slavery. I look forward to being able to speak out on behalf of girls and women that have been exploited.
Thank you very much, Christine. We'll take three questions. Does anybody have a question for Christine?
Okay, go ahead.
He's incarcerated? No, because there. I believe in getting laws passed because I spoke to Cass a number of years ago, several years ago, and he's not able to be prosecuted because there were no laws in place at the time. The most he could get prosecuted for was sexual abuse, but the statute of limitations was expiring. I talked to a lawyer who was working with CAST, and he's not able to be prosecuted because he's not definitely not able to be prosecuted for sex trafficking because there were no laws in place at the time. So when there are laws coming, it is really important that you get the word out and you work with your local law people that are in government to get the laws passed, because if there's no the girls that are out there now, if there's no law, laws aren't retroactive. Mm. My dad cannot be prosecuted for a law that wasn't in place when he committed the crime. So educate yourself. You know, that's something you can do, is educate yourself. Don't get angry. If you're angry, educate yourself. Like, and people can't be, to my knowledge, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that was what I was told by a lawyer working for CAST LA, which is an anti-trafficking organization that works on all forms of trafficking. I'm passionate about domestic minor or domestic trafficking, specifically minor, but I also interned for an organization here in Los Angeles, Treasures, that helps women out of the sex industry. Mm. So we're just down the street. So if the law is not in place, and there's been laws that are being passed where the United States is making movement in that direction, because the first thing is getting awareness out there that it isn't like one type of person and it isn't one thing and it isn't, you know, so that's...
So he gets away with it, right?
Well, the thing is he will have to answer someday he will have to answer, but for now he is not in prison. And you know what? I am settled with that, because it's okay. I can't be angry. I can't live my life that way, because I personally have, I'm a Christian, and I believe that he will have to answer to God one day, and I give it into God's court, and that's where I lie. And I can't live that. I can't live on that like angry, bitter level, because that wrecks me. And he's already taken too much of my life. I'm not giving him one more day. Sorry.
All right, two more questions.
Go ahead, ma'am.
Two more questions. Melinda.
People.
Okay, we can debate that point later. Let's hear from Maria, Jeanette, and then we'll move on to the next speaker. Maria?
I have a quick question.
I'm sorry.
I will just give you Christine Cefa, CEFA, at fuller.edu. That's probably the best way to contact me at the time.
It's Christine CESA at fuller.edu. Yeah, it's the seminary. Yeah, it's a seminary. Fuller. Fuller. Yeah.
Email the council and I'll send you the contact info. I have her email address. Okay, one more question, Jeanette Hopp, and then we're moving on. Jeanette.
Actually, my question has been answered, but I would like to then ask if any of the legislators are left here in the room, if someone, because I was crying throughout that whole thing, is going to sponsor a law that will be federally mandated that will stop this kind of BS.
Very good. Luisa, did you have something real quick?
Yeah, I mean, she yeah. I mean, I think he was just an abusive man. And, I mean, yeah, like she'll call me once or twice a year, but she'll keep it to 5 minutes or under, and basically I don't talk. Because I really believe that, you know, I do a lot of research and I know about trauma. And so I believe that she feels immensely guilty and she can barely live with herself. But, and so that's the best she can do. You know, it's just that there's a lot of people who love and care for me now. And so I'm thankful for that. And I can't go back and fix the past, but I can't impact people's lives now. And so that's the best scenario.
Christine, thank you very, very much. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Nazarian is here. You want to bring Nazarian?
All right. I did see Assemblymember Adrene Nazarian come in. Adrene, can we do one more speaker and then call you up? Are you good with that? Very good. Thank you, Adrene. Up next, Deborah Quigley. Deborah was affiliated with the Airline Ambassadors International, an organization of airline employees who use their travel benefits to hand deliver aid to underserved communities, respond to disasters, and escort sick children to the USA for surgeries. And you just got back from Nepal. I believe you're going to touch upon that. Deborah, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, George. Good evening, everybody. I'm here to speak on behalf of the travel and tour industry and also about prevention, the work that we're doing. As I was quoted in the paper, that it's not, I'm retiring from United Airlines for 31 years, and sometimes people say, what are the airlines doing about trafficking? And it's not just, it's not an airline problem, it's all of our responsibility to raise awareness. Now I've been training since 2011 with different airports, with this group in Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Oakland, San Jose, Phoenix, Dallas, New Orleans. We don't turn down anybody that requests a training at the airport. It's difficult to get trainings at the airport because the airlines don't want to really be associated with human trafficking issues.
Gee, I wonder why.
Then also, I live in Hawaii, and I do trainings with middle school children, high school children, and college groups that are social workers, travel and industry management people, people that work with early childhood education. And the woman that I've been volunteering with, she's done 90 trainings in public and private schools. So if you ever feel that it's not possible, it's very possible. You just have to keep knocking on the door, the counselor's door, find an avenue. The Seroptimist will sometimes have an in to allow training. We go in and we speak to the kids. She spoke to 600 children at the Sacred Hearts Academy in Hawaii. So this is a very doable approach, and I'm all about prevention. That's more my field of experience. Again, today is the first ever international human trafficking, anti-human trafficking day, and it's the beginning of hopefully some big changes in the world. The transportation and tour industry, which is my field of experience, specifically the airline industry, I'll talk about why commercial air carriers are unwittingly transporting victims, potential victims, and traffickers, possibly organs in cargo for the black market. Movement is a very, very big issue with traffickers. They use commercial air carriers for frequent and constant movement of keeping their victims powerless, where they can't form bonds, they don't speak the local language, they don't know where they are a lot of times, and they don't know who to trust. Traffickers need commercial air travel, the speed and convenience, and they use the airports as their hub. There's been situations like in Gatwick Airport in London where a flight arrived and there was an auction at the coffee shop for women that had just come in from Eastern Europe. So it can be quite blatant. Today is not a training, however. Today is just a general review of the work that I do, and I'll go through some common indicators later on of what a victim might look like on an airplane, at an airport, et cetera, and a trafficker in that same situation. Our awareness training is like 60 minutes. It goes on into depth about when this movement started, like in the 1990s, and the United Nations actions, the TPPA tactics, why don't victims escape on their own, psychological, physical, long-term costs, the protocol and reporting it, and we also have real-life stories of actual situations where flight attendants have reported, like girls coming in from Moscow to Chicago thinking they're going to be models. And that's such a classic. You know, you sit here thinking, how can anybody believe that? But when you are so eager to have a better life, sometimes logic does not prevail. And this flight attendant was noticing that these girls were coming in on the Moscow flights that she was working on. And she started a conversation with them. Yeah, they were going to be models. They hardly spoke English. And she raised awareness with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And they added extra personnel on those flights to screen those aircraft when they come in from Moscow. So there are things that we can do. And that was a flight attendant. But however, it could be a passenger. It could be you. So who can help in this fight? Flight attendants, the taxi driver, the baggage handler, duty-free, the barista at the coffee shop, skycaps, customer service agents, and you as a passenger. Or even if you're not a passenger, you could be seeing off a family member. With proper training, we can all do our part to recognize it and report it. Traffickers take victims far from their home, and movement helps traffickers avoid detection. It's a very, very, it's kind of been implied here about movement, but it's, that's how they get around, trains, buses, airplanes, et cetera. Just because you can't see human trafficking doesn't, it might be because you don't know the indicators. Some of the indicators which are common in an airport and airplane situation, usually you have to recognize at least two indicators to sort of raise the antenna that there's something wrong. The victim would have no eye contact. My friend who was trafficked from Bangladesh when she was five with nine of her family members, they were told to look at their feet. So if you see that kind of behavior, they're not allowed to speak for themselves. Or their translator speaks for them. They're not in possession of their identification or their travel documents or their passport. They're shielded, so the trafficker would have them behind him or her. They're restricted from roaming through the aircraft, from using the bathroom by themselves. They're not allowed to go anywhere by themselves. They might seem disoriented. They may not even know where they're going, or they may not even know where they are. The victim could have wounds, bruises, and, as previously mentioned, tattoos. They put a scanner code sometimes on their neck or tattoo daddy, indicators like that. So those are clues that, again, one instance like that may not be enough, but if you are observant, if that raises your attention, you can start looking for other indicators. What you don't do at an airport or on an airplane, you do not confront the potential trafficker. You do not try to rescue anybody. You do not display alarm. You do not endanger yourself or others, and you do not interfere with in-flight services. Those are kind of common sense, but it just needs to be emphasized. We're not professionals in the rescuing and all that. We're just recognizing what we see and reporting it, which we all can do. What you can do is you can be observant, especially of children and young women traveling alone or with somebody. You can start pleasant conversation. You can start asking them non-threatening questions like, oh, where are you going? How exciting? Have you traveled there before? Where are you staying? A lot of times people that don't realize that they're entering into a victim situation, they don't know where they're staying. They don't know who's meeting them. They might have a phone number for somebody that's supposed to meet them. You can take notes and assess body language, and you can tell a flight attendant, or at the airport you can tell a TSA or airport security. I had a situation, a number of situations where there was one girl that came to pick up her ticket to go on a one-way ticket to Oman, and she was like 17, and I was shaking, physically shaking. I'm thinking, why is a 17-year-old going to Oman on a one-way ticket? And I asked her, I said, oh, how exciting. I'm just shivering underneath her. I'm like, oh, exciting, you're going to Oman. What are you going to be doing in Oman? And she said, well, I'm going to be dancing. And this is like 15 years ago. And at that time, the airline said, it's really not your business. to be asking those kind of questions. And then being in Hawaii especially, it's really not your business because of the local culture. So I've carried that with me for the past 15 or 20 years. And you can see when you're not able to act on your instincts or act on a situation that just doesn't feel right, or you know that the indicators are indicating that there's something bigger going on, you carry that within yourself. So it's really important to report it and to pass it on to the professionals. But always remember that things aren't always what they seem. We're not looking for problems where problems don't exist. So that's why if you're at the airport, we're not the police. We're just airline employees and doing what we can do. What would a trafficker look like at an airport or on an airplane? They could be female, male, young, old. They could be a relative. They could be an acquaintance. They could be a foreign or an American. They could be a family member. They could be a member of organized crime. They could be an intimate partner. They could be a classmate. The trafficker may answer questions for the victim. They observe the victim persistently. They could pose as a relative. They may not even know the child's name they're traveling with and their identification or their personal information. There was a situation where the adult was asked for the age of the child, and he had to refer to his paperwork. So, again, that doesn't always mean that there's something wrong, but then it kind of makes you sit on the edge of your chair and just pay a little more attention. Traffickers are predators. The tactics they use, they lure victims by love. This has already been repeated, but they lure victims by love, coercion, force, or fraud. They promise non-existent jobs. They offer excitement. And one of their tactics is, like it was said earlier, isolation is a big, shame and isolation are two really big factors in their tactics. Moving girls and boys, an average of every seven to nine days, they're moved from city to city. Transnational organized crime works together to create a circuit or a pipeline of a series of cities crisscrossing countries and continents. They help to avoid, because they're organized, they help to avoid being detected or tracked by law enforcement. They try to feed on conflict and instability, naivety. They feed on, they undermine public health. They undermine national security. It threatens peace and human security. It leads to human rights violations. It undermines the economy, social and cultural, political and civil development of societies around the world. They have their own economy. They use vast sums of money, which destabilize legitimate economies. Now, the issue with cash is a big problem for them because they have to move cash around. So I'll talk a little bit later about another form of payment. Organized crime is not stagnant, but it is an ever-changing industry adapting to markets and demands. So as a responsible traveler waiting in a security line or at the coffee shop, would you know what to do if you saw something that just didn't look right? You recognize possible indicators. Would you know what not to do? Would you know what to report and who to report it to? With proper awareness and training, as passengers, airline, and airport personnel, we can all do our part. Last month, the House of Representatives Bill number 5116 states that would require Secretary of Department of Homeland Security to implement human trafficking awareness program for personnel within the TSA and the CBP, the Customs Border and Protection. They will learn how to effectively deter, detect, and disrupt and prevent human trafficking during the course of their primary roles and responsibilities. If you've traveled recently, kind of recently in the last year or two, you'll notice that the airline personnel in the lobby do not even have to see you. You can check in online, and you can check your bag in at the SkyCap, and if you don't have a bag, better yet. The first point of identification oftentimes is the TSA, so their job is even more ultra important. I will skip the review of human trafficking. But I do want to state that labor trafficking is a huge part of human trafficking also, where people are, because they're lured into non-existent jobs, and they're looking for a better life, better opportunities, et cetera. You might see people that are labor trafficked in restaurants or in Hawaii we had a couple thousand Thai farmers that came in to work on the farms, and they were trafficked living in horrible conditions, not being paid. And they actually had paid $15,000, if you can believe that, to the agency who sets them up with their contract, so to speak. And if you look at it on paper, they weren't stupid. They looked at it on paper, and $15,000, okay, it's a lot of money. But with their pay that they were going to get that didn't exist, with their they were able to save enough money to send home and to pay back the finder's fee, and which none of that was true. So it's amazing how much money that the middle person can make. One thing that we do need to bring up is that human trafficking is different than smuggling. I know this is kind of human trafficking 101, but just in case that nobody's ever heard, some of you haven't heard this before, that human trafficking is different than smuggling. However, smuggling can lead to being trafficked, and you become a victim of abuse and exploitation. Also, if a person is under 18, I just wanted to say this again because it's really clear. So it's really clear. If you're under 18, you cannot agree to your own exploitation. So that's where the difference, the whole world changes between the ages of 17 and 18. Well, this leads me to at least bringing up the topic of pornography, which has already been brought up. But high-speed internet child pornography is growing exponentially. It's pornography is ubiquitous, it's self-perpetrating, and it creates both supply and demand. Its addictive effects on the brain, especially young brains, is traumatizing. For instance, 1995 in Manchester, England, the police seized a total of 12 images of child pornography. In 2009, a Canadian was arrested a possession of 4 million images. So you can see the multiplication is just horrific. Which this also leads me to the use of commercial air travel by child predators, choosing destinations by statute shopping. If you don't know what that means, it's you try to find the city or the state or the country that has the least, the most lenient rules and laws so that you can easily get away with your crime. So prevention is the key. You can see that the cost in just the human life and the funding that goes into restoring and rescuing and restoring that life I don't know what the actual numbers are. I know that there are numbers that talk about how much it costs to, just an average of what it costs to restore somebody who's been in, been prostituted or been in labor trafficking. Myself, I want to contribute to social movement through effective alliances, coalitions, whatever. Non-territorial, sharing best practices, put aside your egos, look at the uniform state laws. You can use your skills, your creativity, and your passion to help end this crime. The need for promoting and supporting corporate and social responsibility is also important, that we know who the corporate people are that are on board with helping to end human trafficking. For instance, Delta Airlines in 2011, they signed the code of conduct, which says that they will educate their personnel, their vendors, their customers about child sex crimes, and they haven't started training in mass yet, but it's going to happen. Hilton has signed on. We want to support these companies that are doing the right thing. For instance, Travelocity. I was at this Travelocity Sabre Holdings training in 2012 when Travelocity, which is owned by Sabre Holdings, they signed on to the code of conduct. And when I have a choice between Expedia or Kayak or whatever, I try to choose the companies that are doing the right thing with corporate social responsibility. Orbitz just signed on recently. Regarding our comfort zones, we cannot make an impact purposeful change by surrounding ourselves solely with like-minded people from the same social class, the same race, the same gender, the same culture. We must step out of our comfort zones. I'm definitely out of my comfort zone, and reach out to those who are not aware of this issue, this crime, and finding the commonality that all people matter, we have human rights and freedom of choice. From this, I wanted to go into the comic books that I talked about. I volunteer also with a Japanese woman who, a journalist, international journalist, who was trying to use her skills to share micro information with vulnerable populations, at-risk populations that are marginalized. And she's like, ah, comic books. So her first creation was, let's see, where did I put it here? Was Evelina. Evelina was written for Mexico City children. She was asked by Mexico City School District to write a comic book about human trafficking, the kids that are attracted to the bling bling, and to let them see what the consequences are, what can happen to your life by throwing your, well, not that kids have logic, but just your common sense and betraying your family. Then she was invited by a Nepali group that was founded by 70 trafficking survivors, and they actually started a paralegal program where they now can raise awareness amongst women in Nepal that they have rights. That's probably a new idea for many Nepali people. Mm. It's called Chameli Goes to School. So I was, last month, I was able to help distribute the first publication of Chameli to villages that was a four-hour hike and then another four-hour hike into the mountains to the Tamang people. And it can be a little dangerous because if a village is involved with trafficking their children and you're messing with their income, it can be quite dangerous. And in Nepal, it's gotten to the point where there's some, this is kind of extreme, but it there's some villages with no girls. And you'll see there was a journalist that saw a helicopter landing in a village. You're thinking, how can people get to these villages? Helicopter landing in a village, and she witnessed girls getting on the helicopter. So Chameli is so important. It tells the story of what happens once you get on that helicopter and you end up in a brothel in India. Then this last one is a Vietnamese version about two schoolgirls. One decides to stay in school, and one decides she wants to have a more exciting life.
Deborah, can you do a couple questions?
Yeah.
Can we open up the questions?
Let's see. Oh, so I just wanted to share, Natsuko Utsumi is the journalist. She's not the illustrator, but her message when she writes these comic books is stay in school and make good choices. Those are two simple messages that she tries to get through with her comic books. So if that message can be shared with children all over the world to stay in school and make good choices. She's looking at doing comic books for the United States, for some cultures that do not have anybody that's really targeting them except the trafficker. So, I'll be ready for...
Any questions for Ms. Quigley, former president of this council, Mr. Don Schultz? Yes, sir.
Let me ask you, how were you received when you were doing this, as you were hitting these very dangerous areas?
Well, fortunately, the village that we were going to had already been... in cooperation with this group that was creating distributing the comic books. Actually, I'm kind of hesitant to answer that question. When we got back and the people that I was with, all Nepali, I was the only non-Nepali there, when he went back to his university classmates, he told them where he had just been, and they said, well, you're lucky that you came back. So that kind of made me shudder.
Anybody else have a question? Yes, sir.
I can only speak on behalf of the airlines. Is that? Yeah. I wanted to just mention that internationally, it's really quite an easy task to report a suspected trafficking situation on an airplane. The operations person, the captain just radios to the next station, and then immigrations can take that person aside and ask them more questions. But it's the domestic flights that are the problem, because the airlines don't want FBI and law enforcement and security meeting an aircraft being on the front page that they're transporting traffickers. So it's a real tough issue. But if we all kind of begin to expect that everybody's doing the right thing with corporate responsibility, hopefully they'll be less reluctant.
Beautiful. Ladies and gentlemen, Deborah Quigley. Thank you very much, Deborah. Deborah flew in from Hawaii just for this summit, and now she's off to New York City. Thank you very much. It is an honor and a privilege for me to introduce the assembly member from Van Nuys, Mr. Adrien Nazarian. Assembly member, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I'll stay brief. I just wanted to first take an opportunity and say thank you to Deborah for her presentation. Just first of all, the example that you offered of the young lady that you met at Oman 15 years ago suggests the number of years that you've been doing this, and I very much appreciate the work you've been doing, at least for the last 15 years. And by the way, as for the internet issue that she was alluding to, just so we all are aware, based on the U.S. Census of 2012, 74.8% of households in the United States have a computer, compared to 1997, only 18%. So that tells you the market expansion and the potential opportunities and potential unfortunate access even amongst some of the more naive consumers in households to such websites. Last but not least, I also wanted just to say thank you very much to Christine Sessa for opening up. You know, sometimes certain words and phrases become very trite in our everyday use. We tend to glorify and call very many different individuals heroes. But tonight, in a quiet room, in a small little setting, you've demonstrated what a hero you are, at least to me. Thank you for opening up your story to the public. I hope you continue what you're doing and educating through your story, because that's the most powerful way you can stop this atrocious and vile offense that takes place, unfortunately. I wanted to just take another minute and say thank you to LAPD and Captain Ivan Minsel, who was here and I think had to step up for a call he took, as well as council members Nuri Martinez, Paul Krikorian, the FBI, and Mary Magdalene organization, which is here, which I wanted to take a moment and say thank you to my field deputy, Steve Butcher, who had to leave, and Dora Esparza, who were very key in helping make sure that Mary Magdalene organization got a grant. And, of course, to the Van Nuys Neighborhood Council for putting together such a insightful, meaningful conversation for us to continue having a dialogue on this issue. The federal reports estimate that between 14,500 to 17,500 victims are transported. Now, this number doesn't even include domestic trafficked victims. So this is a growing epidemic, and I'm sure if we were to compare these numbers to 10 years ago, it's probably at that phase of this industry, unfortunately, it was a small number. So conversations like this and dialogues like this help very much. At the federal level, I can't speak to what exactly is taking place, but I can tell you that at the state level, What we've done is, at least this year, we've worked on several bills. I want to give examples of two. One is SB 1165, authored by Senator Mitchell, whose intention for the bill was to make sure that sexual trafficking is learned in schools. There are provisions that allow parents to opt their students out, young children out, of course. But the idea of this was to make sure that a vulnerable young ladies in whether elementary or middle school or high schools are aware of some of the unfortunate instances of where they can find themselves and be protected and take protective measures. AB 2035 is a comprehensive state program to help child victims not be arrested or prosecuted, instead put into places, whether foster care or county agencies, to be offered protections. Last but not least, I authored a bill, 1766, which ended up not passing, but the idea of it was to target foster youth and make sure that foster kids are placed into university settings so that they are encouraged to continue with their studies and advance into universities of their choice. Unfortunately, if you look at the numbers in county, it's staggering, where only about 20% of the children in foster care are either reunified, which is I think only about 15% or so, and another 5% actually go into new homes. So 20% of those that are between the ages of 14 to 18. And that's the breeding ground, unfortunately, for the vultures who come in and lure these young individuals into this profession. So with that, just want to say thank you very much for the opportunity. Well, they stay in the program, unfortunately, and then by 18, they're out. They're free to come out and live for themselves and fend for themselves. That's the current system, unfortunately, that we live in.
But the video conference.
Miriam, you're out of order. It has nothing to do with this. It has nothing to do with sexual trafficking. Miriam, you're out of order. Sorry, baby.
Thank you, Miriam. Dreen, did you want to address that? Or
I'm happy to talk to you about that outside of the meeting, but to that, I just want to...
Thank okay. you, Miriam. Thank
just
you very
say
much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, and thank you again to the Van Nuys.
Thank you, Assemblymember Nazarian. Thank you very much. Up next, Special Agent from the FBI, Ronald Schlegel. Did I pronounce that properly? Schlegel. Ronald Schlegel from the FBI. Sir, you have the floor.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. Again, my name is Ron Schlegel. I'm an FBI agent here in Los Angeles, and I do work crimes against children with an emphasis of domestic human trafficking of juveniles. A few statistics for you. 200,000 children annually are being trafficked in the United States. It's not international. It's here in the U.S. The average life expectancy of a child once they enter this life is 7 years. So if I have a 13-year-old girl who's entered this life of human trafficking, it's not very likely she'll see her 21st birthday. One out of every three teens is recruited as a prostitute within 48 hours of leaving home. Why is that? They have no means to sustain themselves. They have no money. They have nowhere to go. And the first person who gives them any bit of attention, of course, they're going to latch onto. On average, 8 to 10 victims of human trafficking are raped in a given year. 85% of those victims are raped by their own pimp. 85% of victims have a history of sexual abuse within their childhood, 70% of which are incest-related. 83% of victims on a given night are assaulted with a weapon by a John, and again, I covered 85% of victims are raped by their pimp. It is a $32 billion industry globally. That is more money than Nike, Starbucks, and Google put together. A common example I like to give is if I'm a drug dealer and I purchase a kilo of cocaine for $21,000, after I package it, cut it, distribute it, I can potentially make $21,000. So in essence, I'm doubling my money. But there's high risk involved. If the police seize my drugs, I'm out all of my money. If I'm a pimp and I'm trafficking a child, I could potentially make $1,000 a night. And if I put that girl to work every single day in a given year, I potentially can make $365,000 tax-free. And if that girl happens to be arrested, if I'm a pimp, she's a commodity to me. Who cares? I can get another girl, go right back to business. So the risk is minimal, but the return is much greater. So what does the FBI do? In the summer of 2003, the Innocence Lost Initiative was formed. And our mission is to rescue victims of human trafficking and provide them the necessary resources to get back to their normal life. Second objective is to disrupt and dismantle any criminal organization, hierarchy, structure that supports CSEC victims. And finally is to prosecute the offenders at a federal level. Some of our accomplishments up until this point since 2003, on a federal level, we have rescued over 2,800 children nationwide. We have disrupted over 46 criminal organizations, which include gangs. We have received over 1,350 federal convictions, some of which those convictions receive life sentences between 25 and 50 years federally. And one of the big differences between the federal and the state is if you are convicted of a federal crime, you have to do 85% of that sentence before you're even considered for parole. So just to keep the math simple, if I get a 20-year sentence, if I'm federally convicted to 20 years, I got to do at least 21.25 years before I'm even considered for parole. Some of the potential federal charges is the interstate transportation of a minor for sexual purposes, sex trafficking, the production and distribution of child pornography, and then RICO, which is racketeered influence corrupt organizations. Now, just to touch on child pornography real quick, if I'm a pimp and I take a naked picture of my 13-year-old victim, I post it on an ad, let's say on Backpage, then not only did I produce, but I am distributing child pornography. So that is two counts that can be filed against me at a federal level. Just to give you a couple more examples, again, at a federal level, there's a 10-year mandatory minimum if I am convicted for coercion or enticement. Same applies to the transportation of a minor. So if I have a 14-year-old girl that I'm taking between here and Las Vegas, crossing in our state lines, that's a federal crime. If I'm an adult traveling to meet a minor, whether it's interstate or intrastate, that has a conviction of up to 30 years federal. Yeah. Sex trafficking. I am looking at 15 years minimum to life if I am trafficking a girl 14 years or younger.
14 years.
If she is between 14 and 18 years of age, I am looking at a minimum of 10 years. And again, that's federal. If I failure to register as a sex offender at a federal level, that is a minimum punishment of 10 years. Something that the FBI does on an annual basis is something known as Operation Cross Country. We participated in June of this year, and nationwide, we were able to recover 168 juveniles. 281 pimps were arrested and are potentially looking at federal charges. Those numbers have increased from our operation in 2013. Juveniles recovered that year was 106. Pimps arrested 151. So every year we are becoming more and more successful. The demographics of a victim, it can be anybody. It doesn't matter your race, color, background, economic status. It doesn't matter. If I'm a predator and I want somebody that I want to traffic for my own personal gain, it doesn't matter who you are. I will do it. Some of the intelligence that we have gathered is that some of the venues that are most popular in which there is a spike in child prostitution are events such as the NBA All-Stars, Super Bowl, big boxing matches, the Democratic and Republican National Conventions, as well as award shows for movies, music, and TV. The circuit that we see here in Southern California runs between Los Angeles, Las Vegas, Phoenix, San Diego, and then back to Los Angeles. Of course, if I'm a smart pimp, I'm going to keep my girls traveling so that I can deter law enforcement presence. And I may even break that circuit and go up to, let's say, San Francisco, Seattle. I might even go back east to Boston, Miami, just so that the girls that I'm putting to work won't get discovered or rescued by law enforcement. And that's a common trend that we're seeing. Some of the venues in which you may find victims, of course, are the tracks, such as Sepulveda Boulevard, brothels, truck stops, hotel casinos, any red carpet event, escort services, and lately, number one is the internet, social media.
Of course.
Facebook, Instagram, you name it, it's there. As far as recruitment, I believe it was touched earlier. A lot of these pimps are hanging outside schools nowadays, waiting for kids to come out, and again, hitting them up. Hey, you're so pretty. I'm a producer. You should come work for me. Let me take some pictures. Let me introduce you to some people. And usually that's one way of recruiting them. Parties, bus stops, train stations, malls, as well as bus stops. Just recently, I was talking to LAPD Topanga Station. There was a girl that was straight up kidnapped around 3:30 in the afternoon. She was stuffed in the trunk, gone. Thankfully, she was recovered within 72 hours, but these guys are getting more and more brazen as far as getting these girls. Some indicators that you, the public, can actually help us do our job. Because as you know, law enforcement, as busy as we are, as involved as we are, we can't do it ourselves. And the same is true for the advocate centers as well. So some of the things that you, the public, can help us are the following. And these are just some indicators that a potential juvenile may be involved in human trafficking. If there are any signs of physical abuse, scars, burns, anything of that nature. Branding, tattooing, somebody covered that earlier. My task force actually arrested somebody by the moniker of CREAM, C-R-E-A-M, which is actually an acronym for Cash Rules Everything Around Me. And he would brand CREAM across the girl's eyebrows just to show that she's owned by CREAM. And if any other pimp was thinking of recruiting her for himself, it's off limits because she's been branded. Poor dental health, exhaustion, malnourishment. Again, somebody covered avoiding eye contact. Inconsistent stories when you talk to them. If they say, oh, you know, I'm doing ABC, and then 10 minutes later they're saying they're doing XYZ is another sign. Has no cash. Is in possession of condoms or other sexual contraband. Use of sexual lingo. If they have, again, tattoos, one common theme that we've been seeing is the use of a crown. If you see a tattoo of a crown, either in a very visible part of the body, usually the chest or the upper thighs, with some type of gang or street moniker, chances are that person's involved. Another sign is clothes, apparel, or jewelry that a juvenile probably can't even afford and is being supplied to them by the pimp, and any signs of any substance abuse, drugs, alcohol, or both. And that is my time. So,
thank you. Does anybody have any questions for the FBI? Let's start. Let's go ahead and start with, I have it written down. Thank you, Miriam. Ruth.
Yes, in the case of Lexi Dillon, her father, the trafficker, is not allowed in the United States of America because of national security reasons. The government of Canada has offered a
asylum, the girl and the mother, against the county, Orange County. Yet, as far as we know, she may have already been trafficked to Thailand. In the case of Jonah Reed, his mother brought bins of evidence against the trafficker to the FBI office before they grabbed her son and incarcerated her. She and her family are under death threats. I want to know what the, I know the FBI operates inside the United States. These kids may be outside the United States now.
Well, my squad specifically, we cover three violations, one of which is human trafficking, which is what I coordinate. We also cover child pornography, which is another section within my unit, and then child sex tourism. Now, I don't know if you remember, but last year we arrested a USC professor that was traveling to Thailand and Southeast Asia and was ultimately apprehended in Mexico for the purposes of having sex with underage children of those countries. I don't know if it was common knowledge, but he was HIV positive as well. So he would be having blatant sex with these children, risking them of HIV. So do we cover those kind of violations? Absolutely. We do have a team that travels. Our country of responsibility is Cambodia. And on a rotational basis, we do have agents that go there, work with the locals in order to build federal cases against those who specifically travel to Cambodia for the purposes of exploitation. So does the FBI cover that? Absolutely.
A couple more questions for Melinda. Did you have a question for Ron?
As far as incest, on the federal standpoint, it carries the same punishment as it would be someone outside. So if I were to present a case in which a child has been sexually abused by a relative, then they would face the same potential federal charges as a stranger would.
But it's now, not yet. And Deborah Quigley will be the last question for Special Agent.
That's your limitation.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and hear from Deborah Quigley. Thank you, Miriam. Miriam, thank you very much. I appreciate you interrupting all the time.
Thank you.
Deborah, you are recognized.
I've heard that sometimes it's hard to make good convictions because the jury pool does not have education about what human trafficking is. So there's that synapse between trying to get a conviction with the jury pool that doesn't have
knowledge. Right. And that's something that the FBI is doing on a proactive basis, which is why I am thankful that I was invited to come speak today. We are trying to educate people as best we can with, you know, schools, parents, teachers, you know, everyday citizens such as yourself in order to have a better understanding of how a case is built and what the signs are in order for you guys to help us, you know, investigate. So by you guys reporting to us, we try to educate the community as well. Now, I do work in a task force environment, which includes LAPD, sheriffs, CHP, Homeland Security Investigations, and the FBI. Of course, our ultimate goal, because of the sentences I've outlined for you earlier, they do carry very stiff sentences. But in the event that we cannot build a federal case for whatever reason, then we can always fall back on the state level. And that's where our task force officers come in. So we also try to evaluate the situation for what it is, because if I'm investigating a pimp who's already a two-strike offender and he's already looking at a third strike, I potentially want to take that case state as opposed to federal, because then he'll be doing life. If I were able to get him a 30-year conviction on the federal side, yes, that's great. But again, at the end of those 30 years, he can still be paroled, whereas the state, he will die in jail. So again, we try to evaluate all our targets as best we can, both on the state and federal side, and go for the biggest bang for our buck in order as far as a conviction is concerned.
One more question, and then we'll move on.
Thank you. Do you have a hotline or something that we can report?
Yes.
Absolutely.
And the second question is your task force and unit, does that cover just the region that you talked about? Are there other task
forces
and units?
Nationwide.
Okay, the main number for the FBI here in Los Angeles is 310-477-0000. 6565, and then just ask to speak to an agent on duty, and then you can report whatever crime that it, whether it be human trafficking or anything else, bank robberies, whatever, that's our main number. I believe Ms. Roth has a handout with more hotline numbers. To answer your other question, we do have task forces nationwide. So LA happens to be the one I coordinate. Mm-hmm. And so we're addressing the problem at a national level. So, yes, there's task forces all over. And, again, depending on what city your task force is investigating, you know, they'll look at the same state as well as federal charges as Los Angeles would.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Very good. Coming up next, it's my honor and privilege to introduce Sergeant Ron Fisher, LAPD Van Nuys Vice Unit. Sergeant Fisher, you have the floor, sir.
Okay, first I have to address my attire, since my captain pointed it out. He says, I'm glad you got all dressed up for the event. This is my uniform, folks. This is what I wear every day. Okay, and I wanted you to see that this is, when you see me out there, for those of you who live in the areas that I'm interacting in, I'm supposed to be there doing what I'm doing, okay? So I'm not a bad guy. And unlike everybody else, some of the others, I need to put my glasses on. As mentioned, I'm Sergeant Ron Fisher. I'm the officer in charge of the Van Nuys Vice Unit. I've been with the department a little over 25 years now. And been the OIC of the unit for over three, and I got another at least two to go. So some of the folks that I see in here, I've spoken with in other settings. Good to see some familiar faces. And for those of you who this is the first time happened to endure me, I'm sorry. No, I'm just kidding. You know, one of the core values of the department is service to the community. And in my opinion, that, with respect to the subject matter that we're here for today, is the number one core value, the service to each and every one of you, the service to the victims who fall prey to the quintessential predators that you've heard about here. And I also want to acknowledge the fact that the speakers that you've had before me have really covered a lot of valuable information that I have witnessed and dealt with and on a daily basis. In fact, before I came into this meeting, I was already out on Sepulveda Boulevard and had to arrest a couple people, which is why my handcuffs are not on me. They're on the person. So the fact that you're here, that you're taking the time to educate yourselves on this subject matter is commendable. And I appreciate it because you're part of my team, okay? I need everybody in here to help me help you and help the victims and help our society deal with this issue, okay? This isn't just Van Nuys. This isn't just wherever. It's our entire society. With that being said, there's an individual who I've had the honor to work with. His name is Mark Evans. He's a lieutenant, now a lieutenant here, right here at Van Nuys. Dr. Powell and I have worked with him. He was in Vice. He was head of the Hollywood Vice Unit. He has since written a book. And the title of that book is Selling the Daughters of America. For any Kindle people here, get shop on Kindle. It's $2.99 on Kindle, okay? It's a great, real basic, what is this all about type thing. And with that being said, I want to read an excerpt from his book. He just a couple months ago put it out. Human trafficking is the recruitment, harboring, transportation, provision, or obtaining of a person for labor or services through fraud, force, coercion for the purposes of involuntary servitude, debt, bondage, or slavery. It is estimated that 90% of the individuals who are trafficked are forced into the sex industry. Therefore, the term sex trafficking is used to differentiate between the various other elements of human trafficking. And I think that that's a really succinct and clear explanation of what these two things are, okay? I encourage everyone, if given the opportunity, to read this. It's a wealth of information, and it will, again, part of what I'm here for is to educate, provide additional information for each and every one of you. It was mentioned about the jury education. Some of you are going to end up in juries, and I want the most informed community members serving in those critical aspects to have the most knowledge that they possibly can to make the right decisions. And again, this is just one resource to do that. The horror stories that you've heard touched on here, they're not make-believe. They're very true. Just last week, a 15-year-old that we rescued was explaining how at the age of 13, her mother sold her to men for sex, and then she just continued with the pimps and the cycle of that whole thing going. It's very, I forget where she was, very similar to the domestic violence cycle, okay, the psychological cycle. The risk factors, you've heard talk about the Internet. The Internet is a game changer with this whole thing. I have lost count of the number of victims who I've interviewed who have told me that they meant over the Internet. And were promised all those things, and the love and the cars and the homes and all that other stuff as a means to facilitate what it was that the pimp just wants, and that's the money. Myself and my officers who are over here at the office strive for is to save the victims. That's number one. Every single young lady that we take into custody, we sit them down, we talk to them, and give them the opportunity to get to the resources to change their life. And Mary Magdalene Project is the number one resource that we provide to the girls as a means to get out of the life. The second thing we want to try to get are the pimps. And it's a very satisfying when you get a pimp in custody and you are really able to take that threat off the street. Just today, as a matter of fact, when I came in, I was advised that our fugitive section had located two individuals who we've had warrants out for their arrest for human trafficking charges. They got them in custody down in Long Beach today, and took a couple months to actually make that happen. But it's very satisfying watching them be brought in shackles. They're looking at as the FBI agent who I've also had the pleasure of working with on a number of these task forces as a team member has explained, looking at heavy weight time that these guys that are putting them away.
Yes.
So it's very satisfying to achieve that. The explanation about how the girls can, as Agent Schlegel mentioned, one girl got snatched up off of a bus stop. That happens. It's called the world of prostitution. It's referred to as the game. They call it the game. So when the individuals involved in that lifestyle are in that, they always run the risk of those sort of things happening, where they can be snatched up, thrown in a car, kidnapped, okay, raped, gang raped, beaten, just all of those horrible things. And that's real. That's no joke. With that being said, there is a mindset, I've heard it mentioned a couple times, we should just legalize prostitution. That'll solve the problem.
Yeah, right.
So that's a myth, okay? That's an absolute myth. I'm going to give you 10 reasons why it won't work. Legalizing prostitution is a gift to pimps, traffickers, and the sex industry. I'm just going to read these for you because they're spot on. Legalizing prostitution and the sex industry promotes sex trafficking. Legalizing prostitution does not contain the sex industry, it expands it. Legalizing prostitution increases clandestine, illegal, and street prostitution. The very opposite of what some believe that it will solve. It absolutely doesn't. Frequently, I ask people to substantiate their statement. I've yet to have anybody do it because they can't. Nevada. Everybody points to Nevada. Look, Nevada's legalized it. No, Nevada hasn't legalized prostitution. There are a couple places where it is legal, okay? Las Vegas, the Strip, you know, what we consider Las Vegas. Prostitution is not legal there. They have a significantly, I would say, almost worse streetwalking problem than we have out here on Sepulveda Boulevard, okay? So that doesn't hold water.